Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guests are Lori Townsend of APRN, Lisa Diemer of the Anchorage Daily News, and Greg Erickson of the Alaska Budget Report. Lori, the Newtown shooting in which 20 children and 7 adults died has rocked the nation. President Obama and others are calling for changes in gun laws. Others are calling for changes in our mental health laws and in mental health programs. What has the Alaska congressional delegation been saying, and what are we hearing from Alaskans?
Well, we haven't heard a lot from the congressional delegation. Representative Don Young has been against renewing the assault weapons ban. It sunsetted in 2004, and he has said as a board member of the NRA, he doesn't support it. Critics of reinstituting an assault ban say that it hasn't had much impact when it wasn't in place,
right.
And that's why they're saying that it doesn't matter if you have that ban in place or not. Senator Mark Begich has primarily sort of stayed away from the heat of this issue by calling for better mental health screening and more funding for mental health services. Senator Murkowski has not said much of anything. She has been opposed to the weapons ban being put back in place in the past. She hasn't said anything currently. The president is calling, as many know, for a commission led by Vice President Joe Biden to look at 3 areas. He's pulled a commission together and wants the ban on assault weapons put back in place. He wants this loophole, they're calling it, as it relates to gun shows where you can buy a gun without a background check at a gun show. And also a ban on high-capacity magazines for firearms. He wants that done by January. We'll see what happens in that respect.
One of the things that struck me about the political leaders is I can understand how they don't want to get too far out in front of this issue, but on the other hand, it sounds like they don't want to get caught saying something that will wind up in an opponent's commercial for the next 5 years.
Well, I think it's interesting to note that on Representative Young's website, he has under his issues tabs a tab for First Amendment tab, but there is a Second Amendment tab. So he is very strongly in support of gun rights.
Yeah, and the statement he issued was very carefully and clearly worded. I mean, that I thought it was, from his perspective, well done. Lisa, you've talked to Governor Sean Parnell and House Speaker Mike Chenault about the Newtown and the issues that they raised. What did you hear from our leaders here in the state?
They're also not going to jump on this and do anything very quickly. They both said, I mean, they're open to a debate, but they're not going to be out in front. They're not calling for anything. They're both have A ratings, or in the case of Mike Chenault, an A-plus rating by the NRA, and they're not calling for any changes, but they say they're open to discussion.
I think in that interview, Chenault said he owns 3 AR-15s. Is that right?
He would not get specific on that. He said he owns semi-automatic weapons, plural.
Oh, not
plural.
the caliber. The
yeah, he didn't say
weapon.
Specifically okay. Which ones, but he did say plural. And he said basically he enjoys shooting them.
And the Anchorage School District, with the police department here in Anchorage, is revisiting security issues in the schools. What did you learn when you chatted with them and wrote about that?
I spoke with the superintendent, Jim Browder, and he's new here in Anchorage. He comes from Lee County, Florida, where, and I believe it was after 9/11, but he said the schools there all have secure fences around them. And he is not, again, he also is not calling for anything, but he wants to hear what does the community want. And he's hoping to, this will be a point of discussion. He's planning to have a town hall meeting in January, and he wants this to be something people talk about. He has asked for a review of security at the schools just to see whether there's simple fixes, quick things that can be done. Make sure that every teacher can lock their classroom door from the inside. Some old schools, maybe there's a couple doors out there that they can't, but it wants to make sure that those kinds of things are all available.
One of the things that surprised me was in talking to, because I guess I just don't know much about it, talking to the teachers is that how familiar they were with the drill in Newtown, that this is something that they're well aware of and have practiced themselves.
And not only the teachers, of course, but the children, the students.
Yes, that's
children
exactly
as young
right.
as kindergarten, first graders, they have it down. They know exactly what lockdown means. You're hiding from, they say, the bad man, the bad person. You don't want him to kidnap you or shoot you. You have to be very quiet. Can you play games or work during lockdown? No.
This is where the teacher says, I really mean business, no fooling around. Lori, you wanted to add something here?
I wanted to add that I thought it was interesting that Chief Muse, who helped write the safety plan to put officers into schools, said that it's difficult to secure a school that was built before such considerations were put in place because the backsides of gyms often have numerous doors. So he said, he was responding to a question about why aren't there metal detectors, and he said you can have all kinds of process in the front of the school, but then you have all these 60 to 80 doors that may be insecure or unsecured in the back part of the school. So it's an issue that isn't going to go away. The NRA said just today, the head of the NRA, as you know, places like Alaska is ringing bells for 26 victims that the governor requested today. The NRA was calling for more guns. The quote was, the only guy that can stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. So they're saying that schools should have armed guards and that they have a plan that they want to help implement in that regard.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's turn to Greg Erickson. Greg, a couple of things. First of all, Governor Parnell released the 2013 budget, state budget. What did you learn in taking a look at this annual document?
Well, I guess the most remarkable thing about the budget is how unremarkable it is, Mike. It calls for $5.7 billion in operating spending. That's almost exactly the amount we're spending in the current fiscal year. And while that amount will surely increase, he left a few minor things out of it, but no big changes in the operating budget. The volatile element of Alaska's budget has always been the capital budget, which goes up in years when the oil money is flowing freely and tends to contract downward when we don't feel quite so rich. Last year, the current fiscal year, we have a capital budget of almost $2 billion, $1.9 billion. Big capital budget by historic terms. Governor Parnell is proposing only $800 million in capital spending, but he has left $500 million of surplus, money that his budget doesn't spend, and he's made it clear that he would be comfortable if legislators put their own priorities into that $500 million. He called for as governors usually do, some sort of great conference of meeting of the minds on how much we should spend.
In the grand bargain?
In the grand bargaining, yes, to avoid the fiscal cliff, a term which we've been using around for Alaska for many years, in fact. So it doesn't seem very remarkable. I think that there'll be negotiations. What could unhinge things would be if there was a huge collapse in oil prices or a big run-up in oil prices.
Now, you did some homework and can tell us some of the members of the House are, well, shall we say, newcomers or green or inexperienced? How do we want to phrase this?
Well, there are been quite a few changes on the finance committees. There's 11 members in the House and 7 in the Senate, and they tend to write the budgets and tend to have inordinate power when it comes to deciding what gets spent. This year, it looks like there'll be 6 new finance committee members in both the combined committees, and 5 of those are legislators who are in the Republican majority who have never served on finance, and those folks will be chairing budget subcommittees, so there's going to be a lot of newbies, and it'll be interesting to see how that works out. I wonder sometimes about how these folks may blanch when they see what
their government is actually doing.
What all goes into that budget.
Yeah. I understand some House Democrats in particular are, well, shall we say, distrustful of the numbers Governor Parnell has come up with for the amount of dollars we're going to have from oil. Tell us more about that.
You know, I sort of hate to become like a broken record. I've been around so long that everything that
this
happens.
This is your fate. It's mine, too.
I've seen it before, you know, and it's like, what's new about that, you know? It's true that when the budget numbers go up, the people who want to restrain spending say, they're suspicious that somebody's cooking the numbers back at the Department of Revenue. And when the numbers go down, people who, like Representative Curtula, the minority leader in the House, who perhaps wants to see a little more generous spending on social programs in particular, or education, she says, maybe they're cooking the numbers over across the street of the Department of Revenue. I don't see any evidence of that. The FY13, the current fiscal year revenue is down, but that's because oil prices have trended down slightly. The new forecast suggests that there will be less oil being produced in the future than the forecasts have said in the past, but those forecasts have been notoriously overly optimistic in the past, so maybe this adjustment will be helpful. If anything, I think that the oil price forecasts are probably a little optimistic because the futures market, which is sort of reflects the combined wisdom of all the people who are buying and selling oil, tends to be more pessimistic than our Department of Revenue is about oil prices, although not by a lot.
Okay, let's go back to Lisa Diemer. Lisa, you've done extensive reporting on the Port of Anchorage, perhaps more than anybody in South Central Alaska. I note in a recent story you chose to use the word beleaguered to describe the port. It was right up there, I think, in the first five or six words. What's the latest beleaguerment, if there is such a word, of the port, and where are they going to go from here?
Well, the problems are really immense with this project. And I went back and saw, and I think my first story on this port project was in March of 2008. And many of the things that are now coming to be found to be true were raised in that story by people concerned about why did they need such a big port? Why were they building it in a way that's not the traditional way that we're used to seeing docks, a dock on pilings? That's what people are used to. It's familiar. In this project, they went with a different system to create new land. And so their vision was to create these cells of steel and backfill it with gravel. And then you'd get new land, and the front of those cells would become the dock face. There had never been a project this big built that way, or not close to. So from the very start, engineers were asking, why do it this way? And now they've found, there's been a big study by CH2M Hill that for $2.2 million, they took a close look at whether the port could be built as designed and found that it probably could not, that in a big earthquake, the risk of it not holding up was too great.
Is it conceivable that they would just have to start over?
That's pretty much where they are. When the study first came out, when we heard what the study said a few weeks back, the mayor, Mayor Dan Sullivan, at that point wasn't ready to say they were going to have to rip out what's already been done. But the latest is that they're looking at three options, of which they all involve ripping out what's already been done, because they started making these cells out of steel, and it did not go well. The work did not go well. It bent. Gravel leaked out. It wasn't holding up. And so now they're looking at what to do, and they're going with most likely just a traditional dock. They'll rip out this, they'll keep some of the new land, anchor it in with rock most likely, and then building new dock the traditional way. Although one of the options, probably the least expensive option, is just to keep the big cargo carriers at their old dock, which were declared inadequate when they started this project. But they may be left with what they've got.
A political question here. How do the people who are involved with the port, running the port, the projects, and I know they've changed some measure over time, explain to political leaders who appropriate money, we blew it, and now we need some more money?
Well, what they have in their favor is that this is a vital piece of infrastructure for the state. Most of what we buy in the store comes through that port. And everyone agrees the port needs to function. So they've got that in their favor. You need a functioning port in Anchorage.
Too big to fail.
Pretty much.
Greg, how sympathetic to Anchorage is the legislature, assuming outside of South Central Alaska, the non-South Central legislature going to be at this point? We know they've come up with money before.
That's true, and there have been tough questions asked in the legislature before, but I think, first of all, a lot depends on how sympathetic Governor Parnell is to the project.
Set the tone.
And but there are a lot of competing interests that want that money, and there's a port now over on the other side of Kinnickarm at Port McKenzie, and that's, in some sense, competitive. I don't think you can have an easy answer to that question. I had a question for Lisa. My recollection, correct me if I'm wrong, is that this was sort of the legacy of Bill Sheffield, wasn't it, this huge port?
Well, he was the former governor, and he was a port director when they went with this design. They had been, I mean, the project really began in 1999 when they had a port master plan. And I believe he came on as port director, I think, in 2001. And it was in 2002 that they began shifting from, they had planned a very modest replacement improvement project, a much smaller project, much less expensive.
Right.
And that was back in 2002. The port engineer at the time quit or was forced out over this issue because he did not believe they needed to shift to this mega project that Sheffield was sold on. Sheffield wanted the new land. And indeed, the master plan from back in 99 said they did need some new land. And this project was supposed to give them, I think, 135 more acres, dramatically expanding the area for, as they call it, lay down, where you're gonna put the, you know, boxes and things coming in. So it would have accomplished that. It was sold by the engineers who designed it, P&D engineers, as cheaper than a traditional project. So far, they've spent $300 million. They do have some new land. They got some rail. They got some road. But they don't have a new dock that's functioning. And so from that point, they are kind of starting over.
Yeah. Okay, let's go back to Lori Townsend. Rum Runners, that troubled Anchorage bar club, has finally won approval from the assembly to be sold. It will be turned into a restaurant. Over the objections of at least three assembly members, what are the details and why the objections?
Well, the objections stem from a history of trouble at Rum Runners Bar. There's been repeated calls. Kyle Hopkins of the Daily News reported that police were called to Rum Runners more than 600 times in 2010 and 2011. One of the bouncers.
That's every other day for 2 years.
One of the bouncers there, Merville Lampkin, is a three-time felon. He spent nearly half of his adult life in prison. He and a couple of other bouncers are accused of, or have been actually indicted by a grand jury, he was, of taking a patron in a back room and beating him severely. Also tampering with evidence, destroying video evidence, And so the idea was that assembly members, some of them floated the idea of opposing their renewal of their license or the sale of their license, saying that that would be rewarding bad behavior to allow him to sell the license. That idea was successfully squashed by people going to the assembly. Dan Coffey was the attorney that said, if you leave that building sit without a liquor license, it's likely to sit empty for a year or two, and that would be a blight on downtown. So they did agree to allow the Rum Runners owners, to sell the license.
And they'll get the proceeds from the sale of the license.
They will, about $300,000 for the license and some furniture and equipment. And
some of the assembly people thought this was rewarding bad behavior.
Yes, Patrick Flynn was very upset, so he voted against it. So did L.V. Gray Jackson and Harriet Drummond all voted no. But it did prevail, and the sale will go through.
Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there and move on to Greg. Greg, Fairbanks continues to be burdened by high energy costs. This has led many community leaders to descend on Juneau and say, we need cheaper fuel, and we need it now. Governor Parnell is sympathetic, and a story I saw, he's talked about something in the range of $355 million in grants and loans to various entities that would be involved in providing gas to the city. Summarize, what is Fairbanks' situation? Why isn't the free market working? And what is to be done?
Well, those are a lot of questions, Michael. I guess the reason the free market isn't working is that the gas is the cheap fuel in gas on the North Slope, abundant on the North Slope, is hundreds and hundreds of miles away from Fairbanks. And to get it there and sell it there under free market conditions would be prohibitively expensive because of particularly the small load. So Alaskans have for years tried to export that gas and piggyback local supplies on the back of a large diameter pipeline either to Valdez or to Cook Inlet or down the Alaska Highway. The oil and gas producers say they are looking at a new LNG plant option at Tidewater and a pipeline to that. Last year in the legislature, a group in the House particularly pushed a $7 billion pipeline to run from the North Slope, a smaller diameter pipeline, very high pressure, to carry gas to Fairbanks and to Anchorage. And a group in the Senate pushed an alternative proposal, which would run the gas in the opposite direction, which would run Cook Inlet gas north to Fairbanks, possibly supplemented by LNG that would be imported. LNG is pretty cheap right now. So there are a lot of these solutions out there. Some are long-term, some are short-term, some are medium-term. There's no indication that any one of those solutions clearly stands out.
If you're in Fairbanks and you've been forced to burn wood and you're complaining about your bill, how many years are you going to wait for some kind of relief?
Well, that's right, but I think Fairbanks isn't the only place in Alaska, the only place in the United States
right.
that pays a very high price for oil heat. As you noted before the show, most of the people in the eastern United States pay to heat with oil, and their oil prices aren't that much different from those in Fairbanks. And of course, if you live in Bush, Alaska, I've talked to people in Bush, Alaska, and they roll their eyes at the people in Fairbanks because they're paying sometimes as twice as much as what people in Fairbanks are paying. So it's a difficult situation. The proponents of this $7 billion pipeline running south from the North Slope through Fairbanks to Anchorage made a major shift in direction announced this last week. And they're now talking about a 36-inch pipeline instead of a 24-inch pipeline running at lower pressure. The idea is that this will, because of some technical reasons, result in lower costs to Fairbanks. But it also, in my view, requires a major export contract, and at this point they don't have that, and I'm sure that would involve the federal government in a way that they're not too excited
about. We're
going
to leave it right there. Lisa, Judge Paul Panofsky has been in the newspaper quite a bit recently. You've written about him at some length. Remind us, what was his story and how is it being resolved?
Well, I'll just start off by just giving a little bit of props to columnist Shannon Moore, who did a column that did run in the Daily News, I think December 2nd, and that first put light on this issue. So Paul Panofsky was a judge in Pennsylvania who was having a good bit of trouble there this year. He ordered the destruction of evidence in 17 criminal cases that apparently was not the norm for how you deal with evidence in criminal cases, because the district attorney there asked for that motion to be put aside, that order to be put aside. So there was some trouble over that. The attorney general was investigating him.
Of Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania. And he resigned his position as judge. Paul Panofsky's wife is Sarah, the former Sarah Krapischutz, who's from Alaska, third generation Alaskan, and from what I understand had wanted to move back here. And so he applies for the job of a state hearing officer in the Division of Workers' Comp. There's a lot of fuss made about it because of his wife's family and their connections. So longtime family on the Kenai, her father started Cook Inlet Academy Christian School. Her brother, Chuck Kopp, was former governor.
And they say we applied like anybody else, or I did. And
yeah,
for the job.
There were connections. Her brother was briefly public safety commissioner, and he now works for State Senator Fred Dyson.
And they listed themselves as Alaska residents, whatever that may mean in this context?
Apparently, it appears that he just went through normal channels and applied for this job and got the job. And then it was written about, and these political connections or family connections were raised, so there was a lot of fuss made. And as I asked about it as well, and then he resigned suddenly. I made a request for information, for whatever public information there would be about all of this, to see what actually happened. And I just got that late yesterday, so I haven't really had a chance to go through. But within that, they did show the job posting on Workplace Alaska, the online place where people can apply for jobs. And what it said on there was that it was limited, the scope of recruitment, Alaska residents only. If he had been an Alaska resident, it wouldn't have been for long, because he was in Pennsylvania until late summer.
Thank you. I'm going to have to stop right there. We're just about out of time.
Okay.
But Lori, this is really too short, but I just want to say, talk of Alaska this week, the Christmas show is one of the great shows in Alaska.
It is.
Why?
Because the people that call in, it's the diversity. People carry the flavor of the communities that they call in from. That was Steve Heimel's quote about why he so delights in having
and
the show.
And I want to say Merry Christmas to the people out on the Diomede Island, just like they do on Talk of Alaska. Good night.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.